right, everybody, this is the Stick and Axe Show. I'm your host, Adam Grubb, and it is summer hiatus time for us. We've had the show for over 2 years now, and never once have we taken a break, but I have to go work on my golf game, so we are taking a few months off. But that doesn't mean that we can't still bring you the best of Stick and Hack. These are some of our favorite episodes, some of our favorite interviews that we've done over the last couple of years. Early on in the Stick and Hack Show, we had an incredible storyteller and author. Jim Dodson was on the show, and he told some incredible stories of Arnie and Sam Snead and those names that we all know and love, and he has stories for all of them. If you didn't hear it then, you have a chance to listen to it now. Here's the interview with author Jim Dodson on the Stick and Hack Show as we go through the Stick and Hack classics here on our summer hiatus. Enjoy, people. Author of The Range Bucket List, Mr. Dodson, welcome in to the Stick and Hack Show, sir.
Hey, Adam. Hey, Mike. First off, I'm not that old to be that close to the prison, but I do have an Al Geinberger story that meant a lot to me. So my dad put me on a par 3 course to learn how to hit the ball, and he said, wear that course out, and he gave me Bobby Jones whale, rusted Bobby Jones wedge, and a couple clubs from his that he never used. And after I got fairly proficient, he said, well, we'll buy you a set of clubs for this year. What would you like for Christmas? You know, so I'd been to the GGO, Greater Greensboro Open, many, many times. And there was something about Al Geinberger I liked. It might have been his peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I don't know. I ate a lot of those in those days. And in any case, I think I startled my father because I really loved Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus was already out there. And I was a kid and I was about 13. I said, I'd like a set of Al Geinberger golf clubs. I got a set of Spalding Al Geinberger golf clubs. And by the way, I think I shot 59 too the first time I played with this club, although I think that was the first nine. I wore those clubs out until I had them all the way up through the middle part of high school. They were very good clubs, and I kind of wish I still had them. I don't know whatever happened to them.
Well, if you came out and brought those onto the show right now after not knowing that I was going to start the show with an Al Geinberger story, I was probably going to lose my mind. Oh, by the way, I have to have these clubs right here. Here's Al Geiberger's clubs.
I skip with them in the living room all the time.
That's incredible.
All right, so let me get through your bio here. 40-year journalism career. You have worked more than a dozen major awards, or you've won more than a dozen major awards from the Golf Writers of America and other organizations. For 2 decades, you were a contributing editor and regular columnist for Golf Magazine and golf and travel correspondent for Departures Magazine. And your critically acclaimed and best-selling books include Final Rounds, Faithful Travelers, The Road to Somewhere, A Golfer's Life with Arnold Palmer, and Ben Hogan, An American Life. And now you are on the Stick and Hack Show. My God, what a storied career you've had, sir.
I've been dreaming of this for years.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing this on the Range bucket list. I'm going to be honest with you.
Well, I figured it needed its own book treatment after this. You
know? This will be an appendix, right, on it.
This is sequel.
So, Jim, you know, the first question for me is, are you a writer who plays golf, or are you a golfer who's a writer?
I'd have to say a writer first. My dad was a newspaper guy when I was my first memory of life, believe it or not, is Biloxi, Mississippi, where he owned a newspaper. He was kind of a journeyman. He'd been at the Dallas paper. He'd been at the Washington Post, where I was born, then went to Dallas, then Biloxi, then Florence, South Carolina, Wilmington, North Carolina, and finally home to Greensboro, where our family went back generations, and my father was from. And so he was a writer, and he was an ad guy, and really clever, funny, wonderful, you know, could quote everybody from Rudyard Kipling to Henry Longhurst. And so I knew golf was his love. He wore the passion for the game so lightly. In other words, I don't think I ever saw him get upset on the golf course. He was very philosophical. And part of why, for example, he put me on a par 3 course and said, look, he showed me how to swing a golf club and, you know, watched me, got my hands in the right, like Arnold's father did with him. You know, got my stance right, all the five things that you got to do, as Hogan said, and he just turned me loose and he said, "Go have fun." And actually, there was this little par 3 course north of town here, that I'd show up for, and it was at the club where I was on the swim team, so I would swim in the morning, and this is before you could earn any money, you know, I was 10, 11, 12 years old, and I'd wear that par 3 golf course out, and I got pretty good, and he finally let me, he said, all right, we'll get you to a real golf course, and then I started playing with buddies. So I think, you know, I was a reader first. I mean, I was, because of that lonely childhood through the South, I have an older brother, but we were 2 years apart and we had pretty different tastes. I was reading books at age 4. Not big books. I was reading, you know, Dr. Seuss books, but
that's what Mike reads today. So,
well, you know, he has that look about him. He looks like a man. Yeah. So he's very familiar with Green Eggs and Ham.
It's definitely, you know? It's definitely my favorite. That's in Curious George or my two.
Anyway, so writing and reading was always a part of my life, and so I think I was sort of ordained by the gods to be a writer of something. And golf then was, you know, even though I was a really pretty good baseball player and later played football, and I love those sports, but I think the reason I fell in love with golf was it's such a solitary and yet social game at the same time. I can't think of a game that has that dual quality. You know, you are the only person who can mess yourself up or gain glory. And, you know, it's such a meditative game too. And I think I felt that way early. And also I lived out of doors. When you grow up in the South, you're just barefoot and outside all the time. Golf courses always had some kind of special, almost a mystical quality. Every little southern town we lived in had a golf course, and we used to sneak onto them and when it would snow. And so I always thought golf had something very special to offer, and so I'd gravitated that way.
Let me explain the book here real quick. So the Range Bucket List is a collection of stories of your life in golf, and it was predicated on a list that you had written when you were younger of things you wanted to accomplish in the game or around golf. And you lost it, and you found it many, many years later in an old trunk. And it, I think, kind of brought back all those memories of how golf has been part of your life for so many years. And this isn't a book where I thought, oh, so there's a list, and then he's going to tell a story about how each one of those is checked off. Yeah. It isn't really that way. You kind of tell how you check these things off, and some you do, some you don't. But it really was just the instigator of your life in golf, looking back at that list. Is that a fair statement?
That's a good description. When I was on the tour for the book a year or so ago, I described it as kind of my love poem to golf, the world's greatest game. If you guys are the biggest greatest golf show, golf club, my belief that this was the greatest game. Yeah. Because of those things and because of the values that golf gives you and the friendships it makes. But, that's exactly how I would describe this book. Those 13 or so things that I wrote down on that list, were the classic sort of fantasies of a 13-year-old kid and, who loved the game and wanted to play the game that brought his father and his father's friends so much fun. I didn't even really have many friends who played golf, and Greensboro is kind of a golf capital. There's golf everywhere around here. But I fell in love with it, and I played, I loved playing alone. I just wrote a piece for a golf journal about playing, golfer's journal about the joy of playing solo golf. It's because I started playing by myself, and I really got so I could beat Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus and anybody I wanted to play in an imaginary match. But this book, I never imagined I'd go on the kind of journey that golf would give me. As a newspaper man's son, I gravitated to that world and had a very big break. I went to the biggest news magazine in the South at 23 out of school and covered Klan rallies and every corrupt politician in Dixie till I got a snoot full of that at 30. And, you know, I just didn't, I had opportunities to go to, you know, other big magazines and even the Washington Post made a run at me. And I think it was, you know, some kind of kind deity said, you know, you need to do something different. So I went to New England instead, where I'd always wanted to go. I didn't write about crime or politics anymore. I went to work for an old magazine called Yankee, the old New England magazine, which I absolutely loved. I had, during my years in Atlanta, the home of Bobby Jones, by the way, and I tell this story in the book, I worked so much and so hard that I think I probably played only maybe one or two rounds of golf. My father couldn't believe I left my clubs back home in Greensboro. Ugh. I was always getting on or off airplanes, and I ran into a wonderful guy named Tommy Barnes, who called me one day, and he heard I was maybe going to leave the Sunday magazine of the Atlanta Constitution. This is a magazine, by the way, where Margaret Mitchell, who wrote Gone with the Wind, worked. And so I was this lone Carolinian there, although Furman Bisher, the great chronicler of the Masters, was, it took, he's a Carolinian. We were the only two Carolinians in that giant city, certainly writing sports and politics. And he kind of took me under his wing, and he introduced me to Tommy Barnes, who had won a bunch of the Southern Amateur many times, and he was a famous Hall of Famer in Georgia and a funny character. Anyway, long story short, he invited me out to see, before I left town, he wanted me to see East Lake Meadows, East Lake Country Club, where he said, you know, Bobby Jones grew up here. You need to see this. This is holy ground. It was surrounded by barbed wire, and it had just gone on the auction block. And he said, we want you to write, before you leave town, we want you to write a little story talking about how this place has to be saved. And so I did. You know, funnily enough, I went looking for that story a couple weeks ago, and I couldn't find it. I know they ran it because I got, but I was gone.
That hit somewhere here.
Well, it wasn't a big story. I mean, it was a fine little essay about the quest. These two guys, it was Barnes and a wonderful guy who was one of Bobby Jones's friends, and they childhood friends, and they wanted to save this golf course. So they were raising money, and eventually a local hotelier stepped in and saved the place and actually transformed East Lake. And now it's a model of what can happen in the kind of partnership with community and the tour, but also people who wanted to save this place because it means so much. Incidentally, that's kind of what I'm hoping to do. I put my name to a campaign to sort of save La Trobe Country Club and make it a shrine to Arnold.
I don't know why there'd be anybody who says no to that. I mean, are there actual human beings out there that disagree with that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't have to tell you guys, but you guys are kind of an example of a wonderful revival of the game. And as it revives, I hope that no game has deeper, more colorful, more meaningful history than the world of golf. It has great characters. It has great character. It has funny moments. It has great comedians, wonderful writers. And it has these people who are larger than life. You know, my next book, maybe my last golf book is going to be about Harry Vardon, who I love. And I've been to his home on Jersey, and he's a good example of somebody who was just an extraordinary human being and did amazing things and won 6 British Opens and basically set America on them. And when he came on a tour, and I think it was 1901 or 1900 to America, and turned Americans onto golf. Arnold falls into that. Bobby Jones falls into that category. Glenn Avair falls into that. Diedrichsen felt, you know, golf has had these wonderful people who were real people, were real breathing, funny, human. They collapsed. They won. They drank too much. They partied. They saved, you know, they led real lives.
Yeah.
And that element, I think, is very real. So this book, over this long and very unexpected career I had, because the golf world after years at Yankee took me in, and George Pepper at Golf Magazine was wonderful and gave me a wonderful opportunity to hang out with the tour stars of the 80s and get to know a lot of them and write about their exploits, and then move on to what I really love, which is the everyman game that you guys represent and I love. Yeah. And I thought of myself, in fact, somebody once wrote about my column, which was called The Golf Life, that it was kind of a monthly hymn to the everyman golfer. And I think of myself as that to this day. So these are the stories I never really got to tell. I told, you know, I got to talk about Arnold and other stars of the game and great places of the game, but I never got to tell these personal stories behind the scenes, like when I went up to see Arnold for the first time to talk about writing his book. So that's what this book is about.
Yeah. So
how's that for a long-winded?
No, that's great. you know, Jim, speaking of Arnie, and this kind of segues into this perfectly. So in the book, you talk about Winnie Palmer, Arnie's wife, calling you up and asking you to write his memoirs. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about that story? I think that's a fantastic story.
It's a classic.
Yes, classic. No, I agree. Absolutely.
It almost gave me a heart attack. first of all, you got to talk about Final Rounds because that's what led into it. So Final Rounds comes out in 1997. That's the book about, it took this wonderful, I was so blessed to have a father who had a great sense of joy of the game, a great sense of his, of the world's beauty. And he, when he was 80, he was dying of cancer, although you wouldn't have known it. And we had always talked about going back to England and Scotland to play these golf courses where he learned to play during the war. And as an airman, lonely Carolina airman over there in Lytham, near Lytham. And so I asked him and he said, let's do it. We don't have any time left. So we took off and we were gone for, I think about, 10, 12 days. It poured rain and it's another funny story in the book about, you know, I being an expert of, you know, on Britain. Having just been nominated for the RNA, I thought I had been everywhere and done everything. And I got us repeatedly lost, checked us into the worst hotels with the lumpiest beds and the sorriest food. And it poured rain like 7 of the 10 or 12 days. So, and he had a colostomy in a bag. So, you know, he couldn't really walk very well. But we had a great round at Lytham. And I was with him. We went all the way to Scotland, to St. Andrews, where he had had wonderful moments as a airman. I had a great picture of him on the first tee there during the war. And so I write the book, and he died. I came home to be with him here in Greensboro, and for the last month of his life, as I was writing the book. And it came out the fall of 97. And I thought if all my pink-eyed, lint-eared, redneck cousins and about five of these central North Carolina counties bought a copy, those that could read, and my mother bought the 2,000 or 3,000 I thought she'd buy, it might sell, you know, 1,000, 2,000 copies. And I don't think we did that for the first 3 weeks. And then I got a phone call. We lived on the coast of Maine. You ever bought anything from L.L. Bean? That's where we live. I got a phone call one day. I'm in my barn office, and the woman calls, and she says, Mr. Dawson, this is your publicist from Bantam. Your book's on the extended New York Times list, and it's really rising fast, and we want you to go on a book tour. Would you consider doing that? And I said, sure, I'd love to do that. I can go this weekend. They said, well, we want you to go for 3 weeks before Christmas and really push the book. So I did. I went to Washington, Richmond, then 2 nights in Greensboro where I saw everybody I hadn't seen in years and some I didn't want to see again. And then I went to Charlotte where the lines were even twice that size. And this is kind of funny. And this is how when you start to think you're a big shot as an author. The line is actually out the door at Park Rage Books. It's down the sidewalk, and there's this little couple standing behind the woman I'm signing a book for. They look like the character from Grant Wood, you know, the American Gothic couple with the farm. They just needed pitchforks and a shovel. Yeah. And I hear the little man. He leans around the woman who knew my parents, and I'm signing 2 books for her. And I hear the little man say, I don't believe ask him. And then the little lady leans this way, and she says, around the other side of the woman, and she says, nope. I thought he's older than that. And so, you know, the nice lady steps away. They step forward. I say, hey, folks, can I sign a book for you? And I do. And I'm signing the book. And the woman looks at me, gives me this really hard look, and she says, you ain't him, is you? And I said, well, ma'am, who is him? And she says, you ain't James Dobson, the Christian broadcaster. And I said, you know, ma'am, I'm not. I'm the Episcopalian. But listen, there's only a D and B difference in our names. So if you want to get his book off the shelf, I'd be honored to sign it for you. The little man thought that was funny. The little woman didn't. And she took that sucker by his lapel and marched his fanny out of the store, taking every third person in the line with him. Because they were sure James Dobson, the Christian broadcaster, was in town that night giving a speech. And they were pretty sure I was James Dobson for the broadcast.
All right, so I have to be honest with you. My mom said the same thing. She said, why the hell is James Dobson going to be on the Stick and Hack Show? She said the exact same thing.
He's fallen far and long. And that's
fantastic. And I said, no, James Dodson is on the show. She goes, oh, that makes more sense.
Now, my wife could come in here and tell you about several times I've been invited to major events to speak. Now, I do probably 10 or 15 big speaking events around the country a year. It's usually to guys like you and women who love the game. My only hope is, but I did get invited to a couple of his big events, and I'm only hoping he gets invited to golf courses every now and then.
Well, he's on the show next week, so.
Yeah. Great follow-up.
Yeah, yes. Thank you. All right, so Winnie Palmer calls you. You're on the book tour, and you get a phone call, right?
Let me set it up. So I do 3 weeks. I'm really tired. All the way around the country, entire circumnavigation of the country, get home to our little town in Maine. My wife has gone up to Skowhegan with the kids. It's 2 days for Christmas. And there's no snow, but the season's first snowstorm is bearing down on Maine. And Mainers are very freaky about that. They love to have snow in November, December. It's your kind of insulation for golf courses and flower beds. And so I promised this wonderful bookseller in Little Brunswick, Maine, that I would sign books on the eve of Christmas Eve in her shop. Two problems. The snowstorm is coming. And I was pretty sure nobody was going to, Mainers aren't stupid. The first snowstorm of the season, they would never come out. And also, they're the cheapest people on earth. They would never buy a new book. So I was pretty sure nobody was going to show up. But being the Eagle Scout I am, I drove over to see, and there were two cars parked in front of it, and I go in. It's now sleeting a little bit. So I go in, and sure enough, there are two people there. One is my golf buddy from Brunswick Golf Club, who's in the book, a wonderful character named Tom. Older gentleman and dear friend and a woman who thought I was James Dobbs from the Christian Broadcast. And she actually bought a copy of Final Rounds. I hope she did. And so, sign my book. I go back to the car. But before I got out of the car, this is the funny part. I thought I almost blew it off. I'm tired. I don't want to do this. And the phone rang on my car. And in those days, this is 97, remember, the phone attached to your vehicle. You boys are way too young.
No, I remember the bag phone. I remember the bag phones.
Yeah, okay. You absolutely. Got it. Yeah. So it rings. I answer. I almost didn't answer, and I hear this lady say, "Mr. Dodson, this is Winnie Palmer calling. I just wanted to let you know, Arnold and I just finished reading Final Rounds, and in our opinion, this is her word, the finest, most moving book we've ever read. We wanted to ask you if you would be interested in writing Arnold's autobiography and sharing the cover title with him. How would you feel about that?" And of course, I would feel really great if I felt that was really Winnie Palmer, and I was pretty sure it wasn't Winnie Palmer, because my buddy down in Greensboro, the Irish Antichrist, as I call him, Patrick McDade, had been needling me unbelievably when I came through here. So I was pretty sure what he'd done. He and his wife were at the pub where we grew up drinking legally and illegally when we were kids. They were there having a pint, and they'd gotten a barmaid just pretend to phone me up, you know, and stuff, get me going. So I thought I was really clever, and I said the following. This is an exact quote. I said, "Well, Mrs. Palmer, that's really great. I'd love to talk with you about that. Truth is, however, the Nicholases are coming to Maine this year for Christmas. And in fact, I'm on my way to Portland Jetport right now to pick them up. And you know, I'm going to take them to a party where I took them a couple years ago. And I got to tell you, if things go tonight like they did that night, everybody's going to get, this is what I said, everybody's likely to get completely shit-faced, and Barbara and I'll end up making out like bandits. I'll have to call you back." And I hung up on her. And I was very impressed with myself. And I was waiting for the phone to ring from the Irish Antichrist saying, "Oh, man, you really got us," you know, but it didn't ring. So I drove home. Now it's a blizzard, and I drive all the way across town, up our long 1,000-foot hill to the house, and it's dark, and the snow is now, you know, 6 inches, and I shovel my way at the door, go in, turn on the lights, turn up the heat, just the old dog and me, and in the kitchen, you know, in those days, your answering machine was on the wall, right. And there's a little red light blinking. I push the button. I hear the same lady say, "Mr. Dodson, this really is Winnie Palmer calling. Arnold thought that was the funniest thing he's ever heard." But he said he's gone to bed. He said to tell you now he wants you to do the book more than ever. But he's gone to bed. Will you call us in the morning? So I dropped to my knees and thanked the Lord. Palmer's had a great sense of humor.
That could have.
So I met him. I met him about a week later down at the Wimmet Dinner in Boston, and we had a great conversation. And I told something in this book I'd never told, which is why I almost talked myself out of this book, because I told Arnold. I said, you know, because I've written about a lot of very famous people and a lot of really, from politicians to artists, one of the things I've discovered is that they weren't quite the way their public persona seemed. So honestly, and I quoted an old Roman emperor my father used to quote, and I said, you know, you shouldn't ever get to know your heroes because they'll invariably have feet of clay and disappoint you. So I told him that, and I thought, he's frowning at me. He's giving me what I call the look, which is kind of a constipated eagle and a pissed off schoolmaster all in one. And Winnie's very, very stoic faced, and I tell him, I say, you know, I really don't, if I did this book, I'd really want to know all the things, how you really are. I want to know the things that hurt you and, you know, and you had to overcome. And I could write this book from clippings, but you're the most intimate hero in the history of this game. People, men, women, everybody feels connected to you. You're beloved. And it's not necessarily because you were the greatest player. It's because you brought something real to the game and people connected to you. So if I write the book, I want to know those stories. And he looked very perturbed. And he looked at Winnie and he said, "What do you think, babe?" And she said, "I think that's a great idea." And so we set off, and worked for 2 years. It was supposed to be a 3-year project, but days later, Winnie was diagnosed with cancer. And so I tell in the book about how, you know, we got the book out and within a year and a half, it was on the bestseller list for 25 weeks. And then we got it out just in time for Arnold to say goodbye to Winnie at a barn, her Winnie's barn on, I think it's on the 15th hole at La Trobe, where Arnold had it restored. And we had a party for about 75 of their friends, and it was just a sweet goodbye night. And Winnie got to see the books, and she passed away a month later. So it was really quite a poignant.
Wow.
It changed my life dramatically. Final rounds and that book really just made it change.
I don't know how it couldn't. And you know, you think so. The book that you're talking about with Arnie is called A Golfer's Life. And to think that you spent that time with the legend and with him, and you got to know him intimately, you got to know his family, your families became friends, you became friends with his friends. And where you started in golf writing to writing a book for Arnie, I don't remember seeing that on the bucket list, write Arnie's book, but you had certain things about Arnie on that list that you wanted to, which was meet him. And so you met him, and then you spent time with him, became friends with him. It's remarkable and incredible. So I'm my father is a huge Rickles fan, and I was a huge Rickles fan because of it. And every time that Rickles would be on a show, his shtick was to tell a Sinatra story, right? It was to tell a Frank story. That's everybody, Letterman, Carson, didn't matter where. Yeah. They wanted Rickles to tell the famous Sinatra stories. Is that similar to you and your life when you are at a party, when you're at a dinner, when you're with couple of knuckleheads like us, where we say, "Hey, just, you know, screw everything else. Just tell us about Arnie." Does that get frustrating and annoying, or does that fill you with pride and love that you are even able to talk about Arnie that way?
Well, I come from a long line of storytellers, Southern storytellers. So we're not shy to talk, and I love telling these stories because they really, a lot of people who are newcomers to the game really don't understand that this about the history and the culture of this game, how it is the most social game and it's the hardest game, which means that you suffered mightily at the you know, the hands of this game, and you have a moment of glory and it changes, you know, it's such an emotional event for people who fall in love with golf. So I've always seen it as, and I enjoy it. I love meeting golfers. As I said in the book, I've made my best friends in the world of golf. I never imagined that would happen. I thought I'd be hanging out with, you know, crusty guys you see on CNN talking about politics until they're blue in the face and drinking way too much whiskey. I mean, I did that for, you know, 7 or 8 years, and I just got tired of it. I've never gotten tired of the people, the nation of golf. People, as you guys, I think you said it, Adam, in the beginning, you know, when you go anywhere in the world, you can meet people and have a wonderful glimpse into their life. You can spend... You can play with them 2 hours or 4 hours, and you feel like you know them. So I've always done that. Here's a funny story that I think I finally told it in the book. So Final Rounds comes out, and then the Palmer book comes out. And when Final Rounds had come out, it had Sam Snead, you know, won Greensboro 8 times, and he was sort of a legend in Greensboro. He had everybody in town knew him, the mayor, and he would fish and. Sam called me up and he said, you know, he's in Final Rounds. So I played a round of golf with him up at Greenbrier, and he called me up and he's an old catfish. He said, "Jim, it's Sam Snead." He said, "Read that book you wrote about your daddy?" said, I'm hoping maybe it's time. I think it's time I wrote my autobiography too. And I said, I know you're working on Arnold's book, but I think it's time I wrote my autobiography too. And I'd like you to help me do it. And I said, well, Sam, you know, I think that's great. I think you've written your autobiography three times already. And I said, he said, I know, goddammit, but I ain't done living. So I promised him I would. I flash ahead 2 years. Arnold's book's out on the bestseller list. I get a phone call from the estate of Ben Hogan, and the family says, we think you're the guy to write the much anticipated story of Ben's life and his work, you know, and his Ben Hogan biography, the authorized biography of Hogan, and we'll share everything. And honestly, it's one of those, I must hate, you know, my own success, because I kept saying, I said to them, I don't think I'm a good Hogan guy. I'm really far more Palmer. I'm used to hitting out of the garbage can and out of the woods. And, you know, and Hogan was so precise. And
yeah.
Arnie liked the ladies and loved to be with his pals. And he's the most honest person I was ever around. I'm not sure I'm a Hogan guy. I'm not one of the Hoganistas, as I call them. And they said, no, we think you are. Come down and at least talk to us. So I did. I said, all right, I'll fly home, fly down from Maine. And it's January of 2000, I think. I fly into Greensboro to see my mom for her 80th birthday. My dad's died 2 years before, so I wanted to be with her. I take her to a place called Lucky 32. It's a wonderful restaurant, Southern-style restaurant over here in town. And we walk in. It's a cold winter night, January, and who's seated in one of the booths but Sam Snead and two very attractive middle-aged ladies. Let me pause here and point out that, and I wrote an American Triumvirate, which it was about Snead, Hogan, and Nelson, and there how they saved the game in the 30s and 40s. His son Jack started telling me about how Sam made a deal with his wife who was a country woman, and she just really didn't like traveling out on the tour. She didn't even like leaving Hot Springs, Virginia. She said, "Sam, you can do anything you want out on the tour with anybody. Just don't bring anything or anybody home." And he took her at her word, and he lived up to that. Olympic levels. And so I walk in, and there's Sam. And oh, by the way, and Sam had a real passion for Greensboro, so he always had a lady. And he would call tour directors up and say, "I'd like a blonde this week, or a redhead, or a blonde." He really did this, and he was well known to be a real swordsman on the tour. And
this
so,
was and Jim, in, Jim, this Sam, was this was before TMZ, so Sam yeah, could do that.
That's
then.
Right,
right?
Yeah, well. Yeah, I mean, John Durr, the old CBS, who founded CBS Sports, was a dear friend of mine. He's in this book, too.
Yeah.
And John Durr told me that he traveled with Snead, and boy, their stories are of interchanging dates on tour were really breathtaking. So we walk in, and there's Sam, and he's waving us over, and I wasn't sure he remembered even what I looked like. I mean, I knew who I was. I say, "Mom," and my cute little mother. Now, my mother was Miss Western Maryland in 1939. She was a real beauty who got offered jobs singing in Hollywood. She's a cute little blonde. She still looked pretty good at 80. So Snead's waving us over. We walk. I say, "Mom, look, it's Sam Snead. Let's go over and say hello." So I said, "I hope he just doesn't ask me about, you know, what I'm working on. I'm on my way to see John Durr in Pinehurst and then go to Fort Worth to talk to Ben Hogan's people, try to either talk them out of hiring me or to take the project." So we walk over, and Sam looks up, you know, and kind of looks at me and said, "Well, I've seen your books on that. You're in Arnie's books on the bestseller list." He said, "I figure it's time maybe we get started with mine." And I'm thinking, well, I can't tell him where I'm headed. So I need to stall for a moment until I think. And I go, "You know, Sam, yeah, that's great. Look, hey, this is my mother, Janet Dodson." And Sam looks at her with this little catfish twinkle in his eye, and he says, "Yo, I know your mother. Now, if you grew up in Greensboro, North Carolina, that is the last thing you want to hear Sam Snead say. He knows your mother." On the other hand, I could be the love child of Samuel Jackson Snead. You never know. And so you see me hit a golf ball. And the best part was, I said, "You know, well, I'm hemming and hawing, and my mother comes to my rescue by saying, well, Sam, guess where Jimmy's headed? He's on his way down to Fort Worth, Texas, to talk to the family of Ben Hogan, to write his autobiography. What do you think of that?" And God bless him, Sam. You know, he kind of gave me this long look for a minute, and then he kind of nodded and smiled again. And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what. You go on down to Fort Worth, Texas, and you talk to Ben Hogan's little friends, and you find out how he's the greatest player who ever lived, and when you want to know what the hell really happened in golf, you come up to Hot Springs and I'll tip. So we shook hands, and I thanked him, and I said, I'll come up and see you in a year or so. And he died a year later before I could get there. And that's really why I wrote American Trombert, because that's really, there's much more of Sam in that book.
Yeah.
He was a very complex, of the three, a very complex and interesting dude, and hated by Bobby Jones and a lot of the golf establishment, but a really remarkable story in his own right. So inadvertently, that all led to the Hogan book. And then I spent almost four very hard, long years writing the Hogan book.
Well, do you think, and this is, I'm going to try to word this question the best way I can. But yeah. Do you think if you were a writer, if you started your career at the young age of 20 in this day and age of golf, that your stories and your love and your passion and all of that would be the same as it is today because of where you were, who you were associated with, who you were writing about, and who you were connected with in the game of golf? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. I don't think it would. I mean, if it started today. I mean, a lot of the young writers who work for Golf Week, and I'm very honored that they have asked me to sort of mentor them a bit. But we're living in a different age. You know, it's a little bit like we talked about when all these, like the Golf Channel, this Back Nine Golf, and they were all going to celebrate this game, the depth and the friendship. And it never really happens. They focus on the tour exclusively. These are really full-blooded, interesting people that came up in the golf. I mean, Arnold traveled, and Winnie, when they got married, with a cheap Ford Fairlane and pulling a small trailer. Most of these guys traveled, slept in their cars the first, you know, from the 40s and 50s, cheap hotels. They didn't have the, and that really fosters kind of not only great stories, the great storytelling, and they came away, they had very rich, interesting, somewhat roguish lives. Funny little moment in the book, Range Bucket List, is when I got out of college, as I graduated, and I came home to Greensboro, and I was trying to decide whether to go to graduate school or take a job in the newspaper. My dad said, you should go out and get a job, a caddy at the Greensboro Open. So I go out, and I have a terrible, they say, well, we'll let you caddy at the Pro-Am. So I show up that day, and they give me this guy who's this perfectly spherical, round character who has a 70-pound leather golf bag, orange, Clemson orange, with about 60 clubs in it. And and Greensboro in those days had an affiliation with CBS. And he was on, I think he was on a show called race car, you know, it's about the South.
Dukes of Hazzard?
Dukes of Hazzard. How could I forget?
Look at us.
How could I forget that?
Yeah. Daisy Dukes, baby. Come on.
I think he was the Boss Hog guy, I guess. Someone told me later. But he was really funny. I mean, he was really character, and he did not hit a golf ball in the fairway. He hit him in every creek and every
Hold on. Let me make sure I'm following this. Did you play golf with Boss Hog?
No, I was his caddy. I think it was him. They said, so here's your guy.
All right.
So shoulder this massively heavy book, bag full of clubs. They're like 30 golf clubs. And he whiffs the first three or four shots. And Greensboro had a huge Pro-Am in those days. And all the celebrities from CBS and places would come. And you know, it's pretty humiliating to stand there when you've got this fat little guy who's laughing and partying. And he's doing unbelievable stuff. And so I don't recall him ever hitting a good draw shot. He hit it into the crowd. He hit it into the creeks. Sedgefield, where they played it, had a ton of creek. He hit it into the woods. We'd finish up, and, you know, he had this cute little stick. He would walk on the green, and he would see a pretty girl around the green. In those days, you could get very close to the green. So that's how old I am. And this is 76, maybe. And he would walk over, pick out the prettiest girl, walk over, and he'd say, hey, darling, do me a favor. How about pull my finger? And she would just giggle, and she'd turn red, and everybody would just laugh. And she would stick out her hand, and he would take her hand, and he would kiss her finger, and everybody would applaud. It was a real stick.
We have somebody like that at our club.
Yeah,
that does that exact same thing.
Yes, we do.
Does he do this, though? The last hole, by then my humiliation was complete. I'm soaking wet. I'm being in creeks. I'm torn by briars. My shirt's a mess. I'm sweating because this is like late April. We walk on the 18th green. Of course, he sees a pretty girl, goes over and does the same thing, says, boy, bring my putter over here. I bring him his putter. He says, before I putt, I need some love. Hey, honey, how about pull my finger? And she does. And he lets loose the most astonishing clap of thunder you've ever heard. And the place just dissolves with laughter. And my humiliation is almost complete. It completes when he hands me $2 and says, you've been a good caddy, I guess. Here, don't drink all this up in one place. Well, I walked straight to the bar at Fitchfield. And I was 21 years old. And I went in. And it was, you know, it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and who was sitting around the bar in the shadows but my literary hero, golf hero, Henry Longhurst. And it was the last year he was in the CBS Tower, and he was sitting there nursing his drink. And I didn't realize it was him at first, but he has this wonderful voice. He was just the best commentator ever on air ever. And he says, I hear this voice say, young man, you look like I feel most mornings when I stumble to my feet and observe myself in the mirror. And I said, you know, oh, yeah. And I realized who it was. And I was tongue-tied. And I said, well, you know, I just had my first experience as a caddy, and I guess I'm probably not going to caddy on the PGA Tour as I thought about doing. And here's the best part of it. You know, I poured my woes out. I told him I wanted to be a journalist and might write golf someday. He listened. He got up. He walked around. He put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, young man, I have one thing to say to you. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, it's never too late to go into insurance. and I said, well, he said, but that way you might be a good golfer. And then he said, but if you decide to go into the game of golf, remember this. And I tell you this from the heart. He said, and this is in the Range Book at least. He said, you will never see a game or a sport or a business where there are more rogues, con men, con artists, and genuine heroes than in the world of golf. And I just always loved that. I thought
that's great.
And that's probably why.
Jim Dodson is our guest, author of The Range Bucket List. Jim, honest to God, we could talk to you all day long. Your stories, your history, you're an acclaimed writer of multiple books in the world of golf, including one Arnold Palmer, Ben Hogan. The Range Bucket List is available now on Amazon as well as at Barnes & Noble. We hope to see you again, sir. We hope to have you at our members' meeting. We hope that you're a part of Stick and Hack. It's your career is as exciting as we've ever really had the opportunity to talk with somebody about. Your stories are incredible, and just congratulations on an incredible career and life in the world of golf. And we couldn't be prouder and happier to have you on the show. Thank you, Jim.
Adam and Mike, thank you guys. You're doing the Lord's work. Great job with Stick and Hack, and I look forward to continuing the association.
Awesome. Appreciate it very much. Jim really Dodson, author of The Range Bucket List. What an incredible, incredible interview. My God. We could go for two more hours. I know he could too. I mean, his stories and his life in golf is probably unmatched to most people. It almost didn't happen. It almost didn't occur. And he tells a story in the book about how his father, who was this internal optimist, in fact, his nickname was Opti, was really the catalyst to push him away from the big boy job of the paper and to go into a passion and golf, and the memories and the history that he has is just unbelievable.
That was just,
I don't even know how the hell we continue the show.
I don't know how the hell he agreed to be on this show is what I don't understand. Well, here we are, and that was awesome.
All right, there he is, Jim Dodson. Hope you guys enjoyed that. Part of the Stick and Hack Classic here over the summer hiatus of our shows. Every other week we will have a new Stick and Hack kind of classic, one of those interviews that we just said, wow, this was something special. Now, of course, we would love to feature all of them, but the good news is you can listen to all of our shows in the old archives here, your favorite podcast platform or stickandhack.com. Nonetheless, enjoy your week, and we'll see you in a couple weeks with another Stick and Hack Classic as the summer hiatus continues. We'll see you in October, everybody.
Okay, we're done. This has been the Stick and Hack Show. Go to stickandhack.com to become a free member of the world's greatest golf club without the course.